Okay, we're going to start in Genesis 15. So if you turn to Genesis 15 and find the end of the chapter tonight, we're going to move on. I don't know what page you have. If you're filling in your, if you're filling in the sheets, you'll be on page 12 tonight, which is part two of this, or second kind of part of this idea of the big family. But tonight it's Joseph and Israel. God protects the big family. If you'll notice at the end of Genesis chapter 15, Genesis 15, and it says in verse 13, "And God said to Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years, and I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions." He tells them way back here when he makes this covenant with Abraham that their people are going to, their people or Abraham's descendants are actually going to be in a different land. And that's where we're going to pick up tonight, is this transition over to that land. And we're going to start over in Genesis 37 this evening. Genesis chapter 37. And this is primarily the story of Joseph. And we're not going to go and read through this verse by verse through this tonight, because we got quite a few chapters here. It's 37 through the end of the book, which is 50 chapters. So we'd probably take us over an hour to read through 13 chapters. But in first chapter 37, Genesis 37 tonight, we're going to look at how this starts. And I just want to begin just to kind of lay the background. It says verse 1, "Now Jacob lived in the land when his father had sojourned in the land of Canaan. And these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was a youth," 17 years, still considered a young individual at that time, "along with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father." Verse 3, "Now Israel loved Joseph, more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him then a varied colored tunic." And that very colored tunic, and we've, I think, touched on this many years ago, but the idea of that garment was that it'd be like the difference between the guy that's wearing jeans and a t-shirt at a business and the guy wearing a suit and a tie at the business. Who's management normally? The guy in the suit and tie. The guy wearing jeans and t-shirt normally is going to be the guy doing labor down on the floor. And that really is what this was. This multicolored tunic was a tunic that was bestowed on Joseph, saying, here he's a youth, and I'm entrusting you as a youth with, shall we say, management position over your brothers. That goes over real well, right? You've got brothers that are ahead of you in the family, and yet you are entrusted with really a management position. That's what happens. And this is going to set up for some animosity within the family. It does apparently indicate in verse 2, because Joseph brings back a bad report, and it doesn't indicate that he was lying. Seems to indicate here that his brothers probably weren't doing things exactly the way they should be done. And Joseph reports on it in this way. And this is probably one of the reasons his father says, well, you're not going to be like your other brothers, just looking out for each other. You're actually looking out for the welfare of our livestock, which is even more important. What's more important, looking out for all your brothers, or looking out for the welfare of the family business? The welfare of the family business. If the brothers don't get their act together, they could cause problems. And as you continue reading through this story, you're going to find out some of these brothers actually have some problems that really could have brought some real, well, a couple of them did brought disrepute on the family. Anyway, we could continue on through this, but I want you to go on down to verse 9. I'm skipping over. I'm missing his dream. Sorry that we missed the whole punch of this. Verse 6, "And it said to them, please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, he's talking to his brothers, "for we were binding sheaves in the field. And lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." And then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" And so they hated him even more for his dreams than for his words. So number one, they don't like the fact that he's told dad on them for what they were doing. Number two, they don't like the fact that he's had a dream that he's going to be superior to them. in this context. Then he goes on in verse 9, it says, and he still had another dream, and related it to his brothers, and said, lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. And he related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? And so his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying. And his brothers went to pasture his father's flock in Shechem. This is, keep in mind, because this is maybe a little different than we're thinking, this is maybe a little bit more like around here some of the people that run cattle, Woodwards and the Stewarts, that they're not always right out their backyard. They're not always just a pasture that's just out there a half mile away. And sometimes these are pastures that are quite distant that they actually have to travel to and move herds back and forth. And that's the situation. So these guys are distant. They're not right there where Dad can see. They're not coming home every night and staying in the tents around Dad's camp. Okay, I think we all know that. And we're talking about a lot of these brothers are adults by now. Obviously, he's 17. He is a youth, but he's also an adult in one sense. And his brothers are adults. And they're upset by these dreams that he has at this time. Look down in verse 11. It says, and his brothers were jealous of him, which we already said his father kept this saying in mind. So we have a jealousy problem. If you look on down then to verse 18, his father sends him off to look for the flocks. Takes him a while because they're not where they originally. Some people tell him, we think they're over here in verse 18. And when they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him, and then let us see what would become of his dreams. No better way to stop this than just get rid of the troublemaker, as far as they're concerned. Verse 21, but Reuben, and remember he's the eldest brother now, heard this and rescued him out of the hands and said, let us not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. So Reuben's planning on trying to rescue the brother in this. We go down to verse 25, and it says, and then they sat down to eat a meal, and as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, there was a caravan of Ishmaelites. Remember, Ishmaelites are distant cousins. Ishmael being their grandfather, Isaac, Isaac's half-brother. So they see the Ishmaelites were coming from Gilead. Gilead is up to the north. They're heading south with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm, myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh, and his brothers listen to him. And so, of course, most of us are familiar with this. We realize that they end up selling him as a slave. Reuben is absent in the middle of this, and they end up killing an animal and taking the garment that his brother has on and putting the blood on it to convince their father that it wasn't us, it was this animal that killed our brother. Of course, they didn't kill him either; they sold him. Now turn over to chapter 39. Last week we looked at chapter 38 when we looked at the incident between Judah and Tamar, what happened there, and how that falls into this. And isn't it, and I don't know if you think about this, but see, this incident between Judah and Tamar probably chronologically does fall here, but it also helps us understand part of God's reason in remembering taking Israel down to Egypt. Had they remained in the land, it was very likely that they would have ended up doing what with the people? We talked about this last week. They would eventually have begun intermarrying because Judah himself did it, okay? And Judah even took one of the wives apparently from the area and got it for a wife like that for his son. And God did not want them to intermarry. And we're not going to go back and rehearse all that, so he sends them to Egypt. Well, why wouldn't they intermarry with the Egyptians? Because they're shepherds, and shepherds were abominable. They were detestable to the Egyptians. The Egyptians wanted nothing to do with them. But remember, when Joseph is going to go down to Egypt, though, Joseph isn't going down as a shepherd. Joseph is going down as a slave. They don't know anything about this guy. And he doesn't go down and shepherd sheep in Egypt. like the rest of them. Well, the rest of them, when they come down with all their livestock as shepherds. So, chapter 39 we put in, and it says in verse 1, Genesis 39:1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Now, verse 2 and 3 are very important. And the Lord was with Joseph. There actually is not technically a preposition with in the Hebrew here. It's just simply, and Jehovah was, and then Joseph is the object. There's nothing in there. It's Jehovah was, and then with the sign of the direct object, was to Joseph, was for Joseph, with is probably a good implication. But this expression is used 4 times in the Old Testament, that Jehovah was with, sign of the direct object here, and then the object. And every one of them, they all say this, they all are worded exactly the same. They never say Jehovah's with, technically. But every time it says this, there's always a result listed. Something good happens. So just an example, we're going to have a couple of them over here in this section. One here at the beginning of chapter 39, one at the end of chapter 39. There's one over in Joshua where it tells us that God was with Joshua and delivered the people into his hand, and it also over in the book of Judges that God was with the people of Judah and they took the hill country. So you always have the result. It always is indicating when God's formed, then God always works a good result. So it says in verse 2, and the Lord was with Joseph so that he became a successful man. Literally, the Hebrew says that he caused him to prosper, is what it says. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. Again, so both times it tells us in both these verses that Jehovah is with Joseph and he causes something to happen in here. Now this to me is the most interesting part of this study. And something you could do on your own is just to look at the places where the title Jehovah occurs. In these chapters, from 38 to the end of the book, actually to 49, the title Jehovah only occurs 8 times. But it's always telling you something that God is doing with these people. Jehovah. And then he does something. Jehovah, and it's always for their prosperity. And then God, again and again and again, when Elohim, the title Elohim, God comes up. It's always this idea here that Jehovah was with them. God does something. There's prosperity that he brings out on behalf of them.
Does your NASB say Jehovah?
It says Lord. Okay. And the reason our Bibles say Lord is because the Jews quit pronouncing the name Jehovah or Yahweh, however they pronounced it, Yahweh. They quit pronouncing it, and they substituted in it the vowels for the name Adonai. And Adonai is a name for Lord or Master. And so they just got to the point, whenever they came to the name Jehovah, they wouldn't even say it. It's like coming along, and instead of saying Jehovah, they'd say Adonai. So supposedly, by the time of Christ, most Jews didn't even know how to pronounce the name. Okay. Because they just quit pronouncing it all together. Yeah, they were superstitious of taking the name in vain. Something like that. Because God had said, you shall not take my name in vain. So they thought, this is one of these things where people go overboard. This is what legalism tends to do. Instead of just saying, God said, don't take your name in vain, some of them are saying, oh, we're so afraid to say it, we're just not going to use the name at all. See, that's better. Just completely avoid even saying the name ever, then we don't have to worry about taking the name in vain. Okay. Now, we pointed this out, I don't know, last year. And I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but to me this is always interesting because a lot of these names meant something, and it's very clear that they meant something, even though modern scholars say they didn't mean things, because a lot of times it says, and this happened. Like, when you're over in the Genesis account of the splitting of the continents, it actually says, And his son's name was Eber. What is it? The son of Eber was Peleg or whatever it is. And it says, for in his day, the earth was, the Eretz was Pelegged. It was Obviously, it doesn't have an ED on the end, but you get the idea. It actually uses the verb form of the name. See, so there's a reason that they gave it. So the earth had started splitting apart, and his dad goes, man, I'm going to call my son Split Apart. See, people did that. People named kids. We don't do that. We sit and we try to come up with, well, what should we name our kid? We don't actually think about the significance of a name oftentimes. But they did. And specifically gave them a name, yeah. And when you actually have Jehovah's name, think about this now. That name, really, if what they were saying is every time they were saying it, it's the one who is. What's your God's name? The one who is. I worship the one who is. That's what they were saying every time you said it. Because that's what the title Jehovah meant. The one who is. The one who is existing. It's not the one who will be or the one who was. It's always the one who is existing. See? So think about that. Every time you said that, you were thinking that. Well, eventually they lose that because they quit saying the name.
So where does the name God come from?
To use the three-letter word God?
I mean, is it a word in the Hebrew or in Greek? Or
no? Well, there is the name Elohim, which does mean God. And Elohim simply means strong one. El is a strong one, or God. And Elohim is just a plural of that. Then you have Jehovah. That's, you know, when you say Jehovah, you're giving an English pronunciation to a Hebrew word.
Yeah.
Okay. But that name translated would have been the one who is existing. Okay. Whereas when you're saying Elohim, you're always saying the strong one or the strong ones. Yeah. Okay. That's what you were doing.
So it's God, just a term you created
to take, I it's been a while. I have looked up the background for the term God, but I couldn't off the top of my head tell you what it is. Because again, yeah, and the thing is most modern linguists are going to say, well, they just used the term strong ones for God. Well, that may have been, but I still think we miss something when we just substitute that name and we don't think about the fact that it actually meant something to them. Okay.
So like, even the first verse in the beginning, God created, is that
Jehovah? I believe that's Elohim. Because it usually, let's put it this way, your English Bibles, when they translate God, it's almost always in the Old Testament, it's Elohim. Yeah, that's just God. And when you have Lord, usually in most English Bibles, when they spell Lord with all capital letters, that's representative of the term Jehovah or Yahweh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Always in the perspective of the writer, this is from Moses' perspective when you're writing.
Which is important because what you get when you get up to Moses' day, you find out this has been Jehovah all along. But he wasn't introducing himself as Jehovah. So Abraham wouldn't have used that title. Jacob wouldn't have used that title. They didn't know they didn't know that name. They were just calling him God. They just called him Elohim. So that's all they were doing. And when God kept appearing, because they were so used to gods being localized, that you had a God over here and a God over here and a God over here, God, that's why when he was appearing to Abraham, he says, I'm the God that appeared to you when you were over there. I'm the God that appeared. I'm the God that's been with you. So he's trying to make an impression that I'm not a God. I'm not a localized God like these people are used to worshiping. Even his grandson, Jacob, he still had that attitude because remember when he sees that dream, he goes, oh, this is house of God, Bethel. I didn't know that, you know, because that's what they thought. They thought God was localized. God lived in locales.
Well, it's instructive, too.
No, please.
It's instructive when people say, some people, they'll, in some churches, they'll always say God. They'll never say Jesus. It's always instructive in what names they use when they talk. And, you know, there's reasons why the Bible uses different names. And sometimes people say God in general because they want to offend anybody. God just applies for everything. And then other people will really emphasize Jesus. Now, it's not wrong to say Jesus, but some people have just, you know, they'll just emphasize the human life, or they're just teaching out the gospel. You know? So it's instructive when you hear people say what names are using. When you say Father, it's, you know, when you say God, you can say just God generally, but when you talk about the Father, if you've been taught more of the three persons, and they do different things, instead of saying God and nobody knows what you're talking about, especially if you're in a group of people that have been taught, if you're talking about the Father, you can say Father, and you're being specific.
Okay. No, that was all. That was good. Thank you. So, no. Okay, so I'm back in here. Now, we're on number three. The Lord was with Joseph in Egypt, the Lord being Jehovah Yahweh. And as a result, in verse 4, so Joseph found favor in his sight, became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge as a result of this. However, most of us are familiar, verse 7, and it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. And he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil? And this is important. He doesn't say sin against him, but he says sin against God. See, even in the midst, even though he's really getting entrenched in this Egyptian culture down here and the things he's doing, he must be knowing how this Egyptian culture works so that he can be caring for and overseeing all these things the way the master wants. But he still is recognizing God and God's authority in this matter, which I think is very important at this point. Goes on, and it came about that as she spoke to Joseph day after day, she's relentless with this, that he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. And it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. She caught him by his garment, said, lying with me, and he left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. And when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her house and said, see, he has brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us. And remember, a Hebrew was one from the other side.
Across the river,
yeah. Because this is important, because, see, at this point, these Jews aren't being identified as Jews. They're not being identified as Israelis yet. In fact, even the term Hebrew probably is a broader term describing any of those people that live up there across that area, but not one of us down here, okay? Because they don't have these. Because what are they? Remember when they come down here to Egypt, when all of Jacob's family comes down, including Joseph, there's 70 people. 70 people aren't so notable that they've already have their own title, Hebrew. Okay, so this is a broader term for the people that are up there, Abraham being one of them. So he's brought in this Hebrew to make sport of us. He came into me to lie with me, and I screamed. And it came about when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me, fled and went outside. And so she left his garment beside her until his master came home. And when she spoke to him with these words, the Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came into me to make sport of me. And it happened as I raised my voice and I screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled outside. And it came about when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him, put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in jail. Verse 21, again, important. If you don't have kind of a cross-reference for these kind of ideas throughout this, it's not a bad idea to kind of this connection between Joseph and God. But the Lord, or Jehovah, was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And the chief jailer, sounds like exactly what just happened with Potiphar, committed to Joseph charge all the prisoners who were in the jail so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. And the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. Same thing that you had at the first part of the chapter. It's repeated again here at the end. God is the one causing him to prosper in the midst of all of this. Now, in chapter 40, we're going to go back to some dreams. And so if you look down, as Joseph is going through there, we have two men that end up in here, the baker and the chief cupbearer. Most of us understand what a baker does. I never understood what a chief cupbearer was, but the cupbearer was the one that made sure that there was nobody. He's in charge of the cup to make sure that there's nobody coming up there and slipping a little poison in there and trying to poison the Pharaoh. And if you think that sounds like something silly to be paranoid of, you ought to read Roman history, because you would be surprised at how many of the emperors and people under the emperors were. I mean, there was one woman in there so wanted her son to be the head emperor that she killed all of his brothers. That even happened in Israel, that you had one queen, killed all the brothers because because she wanted authority. So this is not an unusual thing. So you got somebody that keeps guard over the cup. Both of these guys have dreams, it says in verse 8. And let's go to verse 7. And he asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, "Why are your faces so sad today?" And they said to him, "Well, we have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it." And then Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please." Now, everybody dreams. I just want to say this as an aside, because this is not the main thrust of this study. But I think in these texts, when we have dreams throughout the Old Testament in particular, and some in the New Testament and the Gospels, these are dreams that are revelatory, and they're clearly distinct from the average, bizarre, crazy things that go on in our heads as dreams at night. Or maybe I shouldn't say that, but my dreams sometimes are really bizarre. Okay, you're like, what in the world? Why was that person there? And so on. These aren't like that. These are dreams where when these people wake up, they're not just like, that was a weird dream. It's like, there was something to that. Something was being communicated to me. And I think that's important that we understand that, because there are people in Christianity today that are trying to teach you as a Christian how to interpret your dreams, because they think all dreams are potentially revelatory from God. And I would not want to know what some of my dreams must mean. Because I've had some really bizarre ones, you know, at times. Anyway, I'm not going to get caught up in dreams, okay. But we'll just leave it at that, okay. These are revelatory. These dreams are from God for the purpose of revelation. Did I set that off? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, anyway, so we go on down through here. We understand that he interprets these dreams in this passage, and so if you look down at chapter 41, Pharaoh has a dream. Remember, and most of us, you all remember the story with the two guys? The baker loses his head, the cupbearer is restored to his place. That's what their dreams, and he interprets them. And obviously it has to be an interpretation from God, because I would be hard-pressed listening to the things that they said in the dreams to go, oh, well, that's clearly what this dream is about, you know. Joseph was not being some shrink that's listening to somebody's dream. God is, just as he said, God's the one that interprets dreams in this context. So we look on down then in chapter 41. Chapter 41, and I do, we're not going to read all of this, but most of us know the dream that Pharaoh has here with the corn that comes up, or the grain that comes up. And it's grain, because they didn't have corn, okay? Corn is a Western commodity, but our English Bibles, when they translated it, as corn had come over there, we translated corn, it's grain. So it's grain that comes up. And then secondly, it's also about some cattle, okay? We all know this. But if you look down in verse, let's go to verse 9. It says, "Then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, said, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Pharaoh was furious with his servant, and he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker, and we had a dream. And on the same night, he and I, each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. And there was a Hebrew youth that was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard, and we related to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came about that just as he had interpreted for us, so it happened. And he restored me to my office, but he hanged him. Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I have heard it said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." Again, verse 16 is important. Joseph then answered Pharaoh, saying, "It is not me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer." So again, Joseph is recognizing God is the one that is able to do this. God, not himself. And you go on down in the context. Again, verse 25, it says, "Now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one. They're the same. God has told or revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do." So he goes through and speaks it. Again, verse 28, "It is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do, what is settled. Then verse 32, and this goes along with some of Jim's comments when the guys were talking about God's decree. Now, as for the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, in other words, why does he have two dreams, both about the same matter? He says, this is to show you that the matter is determined. And in the Hebrew, it's a word literally mean the thing that's made fast. So as far as this is, this was part of God's plan, and God will quickly bring it about. So again, as we're going through these things, if there's something I really want you to get out of that, I think that maybe I trust God wants us to get out of, not just Tim coming to this to study, but that Joseph here, in the things he's going through, Joseph is doing what? Giving God the credit. He could have been taking the credit. God could have been given an interpretation of dreams, and he goes, yeah, hey, give me the congratulations. Pat me on the back. Dress me up. And he does that. I mean, Pharaoh does dress him up and gives him the ring and does all this stuff to celebrate and to acknowledge the fact that Joseph indeed has done this. In fact, most of us are well aware that he puts Joseph in charge of all of this as a result. Verse 38, when they in the context, they recommend that since we got 7 good years coming, let's take advantage of the 7 good years and put things aside. But they want somebody to oversee all this. And verse 38 says, and when Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this? And whom is, the American Standard says, in whom is a divine spirit? The Hebrew says, a spirit of God. Can we find anybody within whom is the spirit of God? So Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. And so as a result, we realize Joseph's the one that is put in charge of these things. And as a result, Joseph now is exalted in his position in Egypt. Joseph marries, and if you look at verse, look down here, we're in chapter 41 still. There it is, verse 50. Now before the year of famine came, 2 sons were born to Joseph from Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. I always find that it's interesting. He's married to the daughter of an Egyptian priest. What chapter is that? This is chapter 41, Genesis 41, 50. Yeah. But I believe Joseph, unlike his brothers that end up, a couple of them getting involved with the local women back where they were at, Joseph continues to keep in mind what God's doing and gives God credit every step of the way. And there's 2 things I don't want you to miss in verses 51 and 52. He has these 2 kids. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. What does that verse tell you about David's life? Joseph's life. What does that verse tell you about Joseph's life? Tells you Joseph's life wasn't easy. We look at this that God's been with him, but I mean, you've been reading the story. And unless you read this as this very fast narrative that just kind of keeps the story moving along, this, unless you should come to the conclusion, man, God was with him and everything was a cakewalk. It was not a cakewalk. He said, indeed, there was trouble. And not only that, but verse 52, and he named the second son Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. The affliction in the Hebrew is the word ani. It's the word to oppress or to press yourself low. To make yourself low. And he says, I've gone from, think about that, being back home where he's wearing the 3-piece suit. It's like a guy that's the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company, and all of a sudden he's sold out, and the next thing you know, he's wearing tattered clothes, working on the chain gang breaking rocks. David's life has gone from one thing to the other, and he says he was afflicted as a result of that. And I believe that those 2 statements are important. Both of them, he's saying, God did this, and God did this. But both of them, he also adds that little detail in there about his trouble and his affliction, reminding us God's been with him, but this hasn't been easy. It has been a rough road to hoe, but God's been with him in the midst of this. And that, I think, is important in this. As a result of this, and we're going to move very quickly now through the last part of this. There's a lot of other details that take place. Jacob sends his sons down to Egypt because God causes the famine to go over the whole of the land. It affects Israel. They run out of, they don't have grain for their cattle or for themselves, and that's in chapter 42. And we know that kind of the story that goes on. But if you look in chapter 42 and let's see, where do we want to put in here? Let's go to verse 14. It says, "And Joseph said to them, 'It is as I said to you, you are spies.'" Because this is when they first come. You're spies. Come to see how we are in the midst of this famine. "But by this, then, you will be tested by the life of Pharaoh. You shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here." And keep in mind, Joseph knows who these guys are. When they show up, they know him. Or he knows them, but they don't know him. Now, some would say, why wouldn't they know him? Well, number one, they probably aren't expecting their brother to be, shall we say, a chief official, second from the top in Egypt, because they sold him into slavery. Secondly, he's grown. A lot of years have passed in between. In fact, I think I have some of the math down here. He's 17 years old when he goes off. He's 30 years old when he's placed over Egypt. So that's 13 years that have passed there. Okay. I don't know how many of you ever get on Facebook, but I've got people that I was friends with when I was in high school on Facebook, and I look at them going, okay, yeah, that's them, okay. They probably do the same thing with me. Yeah, okay, that's him, sure. You know, time passes, it takes its toll. But on top of that, he probably is dressing like the Egyptians. So he probably has his head shaved, which was common. The Hebrews didn't shave their head. He doesn't have a beard. A lot of Egyptians didn't have beards, okay. So there's a lot of things just about his appearance that probably also look different in addition to the passing of time. Okay, so with that then, these guys don't know who he is at this time, and he says that they're spies. Verse 16, "Send one of you that he may get your brother while you remain confined." He wants his brother. He wants to see his brother Benjamin. "That your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. But if not, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And so he put them all together in prison for 3 days. And now Joseph said to them on the third day, "Do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers." Now, when he says that statement about "I fear God," I think he's, whether they're thinking he fears our God or not, I think Joseph is trying to communicate, I don't want to do anything contrary to what God's doing. And as we're going to find out, Joseph has an understanding in the back of his mind that God has a plan in this, and this continues to come out in the things that Joseph has been saying all through here at this time. Look over in chapter 43. Chapter 43. And it tells us, if you go to verse 16, "When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said, it said to his house steward, 'Bring the men into the house and slay, make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon.' And so the men did as Joseph said and brought the men to Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house, and they said, 'It is because of the money that was returned in our sacks the first time that we are being brought in, that he might seek occasion against us and fall upon us and take us for slaves with our donkeys.' So they came near to Joseph's house steward, spoke to him at the entrance of the house and said, 'Oh my Lord, we indeed came down the first time to buy food. And it came about when we came to the lodging place that we opened our sacks, and behold, each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full, so we have brought it back in our hand. We have also brought down down other money in our hand to buy food. We do not know who put our money in our sacks.' And he said, 'Be at ease, do not be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money.' And then he brought Simeon out to them." And so he does this event, and I'm missing this one statement in here where, let's see if I can find it. I'm not seeing it off the top of my head. I should have marked it in my Bible. But there's an interesting statement that Joseph's giving credit to these guys, actually, if you went back in the context and looked at them, when they find the money in their bags, they don't go, "Oh, God's looking out for us." They go, "What's God done to us?" They just almost still have the opposite attitude about God that Joseph has. Joseph is like, God does this. God gives dreams. God's taking care of things. These guys are like, "What did God do?" See, just shows you a different attitude within even the members of this family and the way they understand or maybe don't appreciate, shall we say, what God has done. But let's flip over to here in, let's see, we were in chapter 43. We're going to move ahead. We're kind of jumping over the story. I want to go to chapter 45. Chapter 45, and I want to, verse 1, it says, "Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, 'Have everyone go out from me.' And so there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come closer to me.' And they came closer, and he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not grieve or angry with yourselves, because you sold me here. For, now notice this, you guys sold me, but notice this, but God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth, and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh and a lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt.'" Think about this. Everything that he's going through, he looks back and he goes, "You guys, I know what you did, but God's the one that sent this. God's the one that set this all up." And again, this is, to me, this is really great, because some of these patriarchs don't always make some of the most outstanding choices. You look at some of them, you're going, "Wow, yeah, okay, that's me. I'm the one that, you know, falls down and makes a mess of things." But you look at Joseph, and here, to me, it is an encouragement to find one of these patriarchs that really does continue to keep in perspective, even through all the crummy stuff that he goes through, keep in perspective that God is the one behind this, that God's the one that's been doing these things. I wouldn't even say God's omniscience. I would just say God's plan. Absolutely. That's the key thing, is that God really is in control every step away. You're talking to, Ben was asking Jim some questions about the decree when we were sitting in there just briefly, and then I had some questions that somebody had asked me, and I was just telling Jim that these questions were asked. People want to know these things. But to me, this is, if you look at the way Joseph gives credit to God every step of the way, it's like God's several steps, he's way many steps ahead of the whole thing. He doesn't at the last minute send somebody down to Egypt. He sends someone down there 13 years ahead of time before any of these things ever come about, and puts everything into play. Okay, and remember, he's 30 years old when he's put over Egypt, but when he's put over Egypt, that's not when those guys first show up. Because there's 7 years of great where he's collecting everything before the famine. And these guys don't show up till after the famine. So he's actually been down in Egypt 20 years by the time these guys show up. I wasn't reading all my math down here. I had to think about this.
Did he send Joseph down there so he could feed him for this famine? Or did he send him down because of the promise he made to Abraham?
That's why we started in Genesis 15. God had made a promise to Abraham that he was going to take the family down there and bring them back. And this is what he's doing. So it's more than just that you're going to eat. So we end this then by turning to Genesis chapter 50. And it certainly does do that, doesn't it? It does do that. Yeah, circle all that apply, yes. Genesis chapter 50 then.
Well, hang on, before you do this, what was the verse in 15? What was the promise he said that he would take them down?
And they
will
be enslaved in the street for 400 years. Yeah. So this is the dream, the nightmare. Okay, that's where you started. Yeah, and God passes through the animals. So he actually does not only makes a promise, but he makes it as a covenant promise, a contractual promise.
Wait, I didn't think the Israelites were full-time slavery yet. I mean,
they will be.
Yeah.
Say sometime after Joseph's death, then eventually. These become slaves, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is where we'll pick up with our story in a couple weeks. Chapter 50 then, Genesis chapter 50. We blitzed through a lot of story tonight. I know you're all going to want to go home in the next couple nights, read all these chapters yourselves, and review this all the full details of the story. But in Genesis chapter 50, if you go to verse 12, Jacob dies, their father, Israel. And it says in verse 12, and thus his sons did for him as he had charged them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan, and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. Remember, he did that in which he buried Sarah. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. And when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him? And so they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, your father charged before he died, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. But now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. And Joseph said, this is important, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? But and as for you, you meant evil against me. God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. And when it says many people, yeah, we can be generous and say all the people that were affected by the acceptance of the grain. But I really think many people alive is specifically the many people that comprise the people of Israel. Because remember, they're 70 strong initially when they come up there. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And so he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. I think it's really important here at the end of this book, with all the things, here you've got at the beginning of the book, God creating and doing everything good in Genesis 1. Then you've got all this stuff from the fall and all the tragedy and everything that goes on in here. And at the end, the book kind of ends with God again. God hasn't gone to, I don't know what to do with this mess. Even at the end of all this, in the middle of this mess, he says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. God's still really in the business of doing good. And he did it here because he had made a promise to Abraham. And he's continuing, and he reiterated, we've seen that, he repeated the promise to Isaac, he repeated the promise to Jacob, and now even Joseph here understands this promise. And at the end of this book, for those of you that aren't familiar with how this book ends, verse 22, Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons, also the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath or by swearing to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. See, he, even if the brothers don't appreciate it, Joseph still counts God's promise of that land to be real. And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. And if you haven't read the end of the story, you go over when they come into the land over in Joshua, and they've carried with them. In fact, we're going to see it in Exodus. When they leave, it says that they take the bones, but when they get to the land, they bury Joseph. They towed him around all that time. Probably not in a stone sarcophagus, because that would have been a little bit heavy. And by the time 400 and some years pass, there's probably not much left of Joseph inside there. It's not too heavy. But nonetheless, not trying to minimize, but they carry him back because there was a man that had such confidence in God to do what God said that he says, you take my bones up when you go. Because that's what he wanted. Okay. In fact, Jim kind of covered a little bit of that in the adult class. Out of Ezekiel 37, when they see that valley of dry bones, and in connection with that, remember, they said our hope is all dried up. We have no hope. Because what was their hope? To be resurrected. And even in Ezekiel's day, they'd given up on that hope. And a lot of them had given up that hope in Paul's day. here was a guy way back here. He didn't give up on that hope, even despite all the stuff that had happened along the way. Okay, any questions? Next week we'll come back and look at some comparison contrasts, but if you got some questions here tonight. Oh, okay, yes. And they do. They do indeed do that, don't they? Yeah.
But they kind of lie right before that, right? Your father left these instructions. Don't hurt us.
Yeah. And who knows? I mean, maybe they lie. Maybe Jacob did indeed. Maybe they said, Dad, tell us that Joseph can't do anything bad when you're gone. You know, maybe they asked him that. I don't know. It doesn't say that they lied. We kind of maybe presume that they did, but. Yeah. I would think that too.
But no explanation. Just that's the name.
Right. I have no insights on that. If you're looking for anything.
That's what I was looking for.
Maybe I'll go home and look at the commentaries. Smart guys, they'll tell me. I don't.
You want to know what the Miami Bible says?
Sure.
I don't know what this is. It says, Pharaoh may have been trying to make Joseph more acceptable by giving him an Egyptian name and wife. He probably wanted to, one, lay down the fact that Joseph was a nomadic shepherd, kind of like what Tim was saying, an occupation disliked by the Egyptians, and two, make Joseph's name easier for Egyptians to pronounce. And remember, and three, show how highly he was honored by giving him the daughter of a prominent Egyptian official.
Another question is, we like to watch history Egyptian shows and stuff like that now. And they never say anything about, they have tons of stuff about Egyptian history. They never say anything about this time where somebody from I'm sure there's some in their history somewhere, but they didn't talk about it ever, probably because it goes against anything, everything the liberals do.
Mm-hmm.
But and I'm sure this was mentioned to every guy, I remember, but do you know about when in history this would have been, what dynasty or whatever?
That I could not tell you off the top of my head. I think I've read a little bit about it, but it's not a thing that I've... But the interesting thing is they're trying to read history. They're trying to read back into history roughly 2,000 years. It's not 1,800 years about this time, but yeah. And they're trying to go back and say, yeah, we have confidence that this never happened. And the problem is a lot of times when you read a lot of histories of a lot of people, they tend to be very idealized. You know, they always want to throw themselves in a very positive. To me, that's one of the most amazing things about reading the Old Testament. It's the most odd history you've ever read. Because it's like, yeah, over half the people are stinkers. You know, the kings are horrible. And, you know.
Germany makes movies of World War II. They don't portray themselves as monsters. They cover battle sequences and stuff where they won, where they were the heroes. Because nobody wants to view themselves as an awful person.
And there, and I have read one other. I did read something. I have to go see if I can find out where I found it again. But it was a statement in his about Egyptian history that there is kind of a spot in Egyptian history that's kind of messed up. There was a lot of turmoil that went on in Egypt, and that happens obviously with dynasties and overthrows and such. But it had to do with. I guess we'd call it the Exodus is what it did. It had to do with the departure. It had to do with a number of the things that were built. And the thing is, we do kind of know when this was because we do. It tells us like one of the people that was. Yeah, and off the top of my head, now I can't remember it, but I think we're gonna maybe hit it down the road in one of these studies. But it actually talks about who was there at that time, one of the pharaohs, and it was either just before or just after. I can't remember which. So.
That same tour guide, the
pharaoh's daughter, having Moses.
Oh yeah.
Which threw away that, and she actually had an answer for this. That she took us to, that big museum in Egypt, and there's one.
Mummy.
Not a mummy yet.
Oh, statue.
Oh, statue.
It's all broke up. The big town all broke up. And the things that are made, let's see, if they're living, they're one color, and if they're dead, they're another.
If they died before something, they're black.
Yeah.
And if they died after they reigned so many years or something.
Anyway, this one statue is all broke up, and they suspect that was the one because they never wanted to speak their name again.
Tried to destroy everything out of wreckage.
So even though she said they didn't have slaves, they related that.
Then I have a comment. This verse in chapter 39, verse 21. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. I think that's a really cool verse for mercy. Because a lot of people, they always say mercy, it's you're suffering because of sin, and they always interpret it because you sin. And that's kind of a cool verse because we should, kind of thankful every day for the mercy of God to us. It doesn't mean that necessarily you sin, but we suffer because of human weakness, because of the fallen world. We suffer every day.
So there might be people that put you to these kind of problems. And so you're yeah.
Let me get a new question. Yeah, if Joseph didn't sin. So that's a great verse to show that. And that's the first time I've seen a verse that actually shows that mercy in a positive sense. You didn't do anything bad there.
Yeah. And that would be mercy without the word, because I think that it is kesed, but just to make it complicated.
Thank you. You said that statement was made four times God, the Lord was with him, with this person.
Yeah.
I think it's safe to think that that's an actual visible presentation of Jehovah before these people had time to give them. It wasn't just as it wouldn't be metaphorical, but something physical manifestation where he actually knew that here's the Lord right presently with me. Nobody else is around to see, but he comes and appears before me and gives me comfort.
That is my opinion in light of how God has dealt with people before when he appeared to them and spoke, talked to them at different times. If a person wanted to disagree with me, I probably wouldn't fight with them over it. But I think if a person doesn't have a problem with that, you can really appreciate the way God was operating, and he kind of set up a precedent for that through this time, and he's going to continue to do so until essentially he separates himself from the people of Israel at Sinai. So, yeah. So, I would agree, Jim. I think that is what he's doing. In fact, I'm not for sure, but the one over in Joshua, when he says he's with Joshua, keep in mind, because the Lord does physically appear to Joshua. Remember when he's out there walking right before they're going to take Jericho, and he goes, "Who are you? Are you with the Lord?" Or he sees that man out there. This is, and it's kind of the same thing that, that Moses goes through. You know, this is your, this is holy where you're at here. So God's word always good.
So cool. When it says that God walked with Enoch,
he walked. Enoch walked with God. Yeah, yeah.
And when God came and physically had an encounter with Jacob, it says something.
Yes. Yeah.
And it says he gave Joseph a dream.
Mm-hmm. Well, gave him the interpretation of the dream. Yeah.
Well, no, he gave him.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Two dreams. That were basically promised to him.
Right.
But it doesn't say.
But it does say later that God gives Joseph the interpretation of the dream.
Well, yes.
And
it doesn't say
that he was walking with him.
He was with Joseph.
Right.
He's with us too. Have we seen a physical manifestation?
Yeah, I just, we don't have a precedence for it today. We have a different relationship. At that time, God had set up a. Yeah, and
so
that's why I'm saying I would
say that it's not what Scripture says.
But it says he was with him, and so that's the thing: is what does that mean when it says he was with him?
And we know from those over that where it says so that that is it. But
right.
To take that and say, well, that it was there, so it was there. That's not necessarily true.
Yeah, that's just why I said I wouldn't argue if a person didn't agree. But I kind of think that's the precedence that God set up for the way this operated. So. And I don't know how God gave him the interpretation of the dream. Did God just cause him to understand it, or did God actually tell him the interpretation of the dream? That's one of the other questions in those contexts that I wonder. So, okay, well, let's close with a word of prayer then. Our Father, we're thankful for your word. We're thankful for every last part of it, even those parts that don't specifically address our conduct. Because we find encouragement in there as we see you faithful to your plan, faithful to what you're doing, faithful to the promises and the people that you made those promises to. And even the encouragement that we receive from a person like Joseph, that through all the things that he went through, he continued to recognize that you were the one that was really in charge. And Lord, we likewise sometimes face things where we're going to go through sometimes really horrible things in life. And yet we, like Joseph, we can be reminded that you are the God that is still in charge. And though you may have made different promises to us than to he and his people, you have made promises to us, and you will remain faithful to them, just as you were faithful to those promises to them. And we're thankful for that, then. Amen.